from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, President Obama has said repeatedly that the use of chemical weapons in Syria would cross a red line for the United States. With banned chemical weapons purportedly unleashed on rebel-held suburbs of Damascus last week, a U.S. intervention in Syria appears unavoidable. We'll ask our experts what the next steps are for the United States in Syria, and we want to hear from you. Should the United States intervene militarily in Syria? Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The civil war in Syria has claimed the lives of more than 100,000 and led to some 4 million fleeing the country, as well as creating even more destabilization in the Middle East. Military action by the West now appears imminent following what appears to have been an attack by the Assad government on insurgents in Ghouta on the outskirts of Damascus, which took hundreds of lives and crossed what President Obama termed a red line. The use of chemical weaponry. The Assad regime denies the use of chemical weapons and blames the rebel forces for their being used, but this administration appears convinced that they indeed were used by Syria, an action which Secretary of State John Kerry has called a moral obscenity. United States, Britain, and France have labeled the evidence of chemical weapons use undeniable. So what, if any, military action should be taken? Is a military attack justified, legal, legitimate? Earlier today in Great Britain, Prime Minister David Cameron, who believes pretty solidly in intervention, military intervention, that is, being legally justified, found opposition in the British Parliament, with many there, particularly in the Labour Party, wanting to see compelling evidence. We'll discuss questions about military intervention in Syria in this forum hour, but first, how are people in Syria reacting to the threat of airstrikes on their country? BBC reporter Jeremy Bowen is in Damascus, and earlier today he gave the short assessment of what he is seeing and hearing.
It seems to me that outside it's not that busy, but people are moving, people are going to work, those who have jobs. Damascus doesn't look all that different to the way that it usually looks, to be quite honest with you, here in the center of the city. In a way, it seems like business as usual. In the early hours of the morning, there were various quite noisy bombardments, outgoing fire from government positions into the places where armed rebels are in the suburbs. Not, you know, exceptionally heavy by Damascus standards, but certainly quite sustained. It's not like the city has completely gone to ground and is waiting for whatever might be coming. I think people are getting on with things. And also, don't forget that the whole process of decision on this has been quite closely and publicly reported. So people, you know, they have TVs, they have the internet, and so they know that Obama, for example, right now is saying, well, we haven't taken our final decision. So they're thinking, well, we'll go outside then and we'll go and do what we have to do.
That was the BBC's Middle East editor, Jeremy Bowen, reporting from Syria early today. And joining us for this hour discussion, this opening forum hour, here in studio is Anya Manuel. She's a lecturer in International Policy Studies program at Stanford University, a partner at Rice-Hadley Group, LLC, a strategic consulting firm, and she served in the State Department from 2005 to 2007. And we welcome you. Good morning.
Thank you.
Also want to welcome Phyllis Bennis back to Forum, fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, author of such books as Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the United Nations Defy U.S. Power, and Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terrorism. She joins us from the nation's capital. Welcome, Phyllis Bennis.
Great to be with you, Michael. Thanks.
Great to have you here. And let me begin with Anya Manuel again, who is here with us in studio. It seems from an American position, and British and French, although the British are holding back, that the evidence is compelling, at least where David Cameron is concerned, not necessarily where many in the British Parliament, particularly the Labour Party, are concerned. We have these video images. We have intelligence which tells us supposedly that there was a phone call, or a number of phone calls that give us certainty about the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime. How do we know, because you're in favor of military intervention, we'll talk about what you are advocating, but how do we know that it was the Assad regime and not the rebels, or for that matter, not some rogue group within the Assad government?
Mm-hmm. It's a very good question. And of course, we don't know for sure out here without the classified information. I would imagine Secretary Kerry's speech was quite forceful earlier this week. And I would imagine that our intel community has pretty strong evidence that it was the Assad regime, even if perhaps it wasn't directly ordered by Assad. It was ordered by his forces. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gone out there to make those strong statements.
And why would they, after all this killing, and now that they're kind of in the lead, so to speak, in the civil war, why would they use chemical weapons at this point?
That is a very good question. Very difficult to see the rationale of the Assad regime, but they haven't always been rational. There were opportunities to negotiate and to stop the conflict before, and so far Assad has gone on murdering his own people and, as you said, creating 100,000 killed and several million refugees.
What will the nature of military intervention do, and what sort of military intervention are you advocating or do you think would be appropriate for the United States?
It's a good question. I think, of course, all the talk in the past couple of days has been about cruise missile strikes. I think cruise missile strikes are an appropriate first response if you're just trying to wrap Assad on the knuckles. But then we need to think very carefully about what does Chapter 2 look like? What are we really trying to achieve in Syria? If the goal is regime change, a much more active and concerted military response is going to be necessary. And I think the U.S. people, especially right now, don't have an appetite for that sort of intensive military intervention.
Now the polls are running between 70% and 80% against that. But military intervention on the side of the rebels or against the Assad regime would lead, perhaps in many people's minds, inevitably to a Islamic regime that would have a great deal of influence under al-Qaeda. So where is it the United States' advantage here?
Right. I think there is a happy medium here, although there are far from perfect options, and it's a very difficult decision for the Obama administration. It's been characterized as very binary, but there's actually a range of things you can do, from humanitarian aid to the rebels, massively stepping up military aid to the rebels. Those are two things that I would advocate, with the goal of that being fighting at least to a stalemate, because you can't have the outcome here being that either Assad wins completely or that the extremists, who now dominate many of the rebel factions, win outright. So I think, as unfortunate as it is, the goal here would be to get to a stalemate where you can have a negotiated settlement that probably removes Assad from power, but has some protections for all minorities, including the Alawite Shia minority.
And you think that cruise missiles would perhaps bring the Syrians to the table or help expedite that?
I think cruise missiles alone probably won't. So I hope that further plans are being made by the Obama administration, such as the ones I suggested.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, a rap on the knuckles is essentially what we're hearing from Anya Manuel. You had an article in The Nation where you said any kind of military intervention would be reckless, dangerous, and illegal.
Absolutely. Secretary Kerry was indeed very forceful. He was also, at least in part of his speech, wrong when he made the claim that a big piece of evidence is the fact that the regime in Damascus had delayed granting permission for the UN inspection team to get on the ground, and that was somehow evidence that they were trying to hide something and therefore must be guilty. It turns out that the regime didn't delay permission. The permission didn't actually get to Damascus in the formal formal diplomatic request that came with Angela Kane, the UN disarmament chief, when she arrived in Damascus on Saturday. She made the request. The answer was given on Sunday, which was yes, and the team went in on Monday. That's hardly evidence of major delay. What Kerry was indicating was that the public announcement by the UN that there will be a request should have been responded to by the regime in Damascus. Now, you can argue that, yes, they should have. They should have done a lot of things, like not repress their own people for so many years, like not collaborate with the United States in interrogating and torturing prisoners like the Canadian Maher Arar, at the request of the Bush administration. They should do lots of things differently. But this is a dictatorship that you deal with what you've got, and no government at war is going to respond to a press release. When they got the formal request, they said, yes, the inspectors are now on the ground. The U.S. immediately called for them to be withdrawn on the grounds that they had waited too long and they could no longer get decent material. It turns out, yes, they can, and they are. So the first thing is to wait. The second thing is to recognize that we don't know who is responsible. It is certainly possible that the regime has pulled this off. We've known for years that they've had a chemical weapons arsenal. They're one of the few countries in the world that is not a signatory to the Chemical Weapons Treaty, so that's certainly a possibility. But to deny the possibility that it also could be one of these extremist elements that are now, as everybody agrees, dominant in the opposition would be crazy. If you look at who actually stood to benefit, it's those who want greater military intervention on the part of the U.S. and U.S. allies. So, you know, I think we have to start with, we don't know who it was. At this point, we don't even know for sure what kind of a weapon it was. We don't know that it was sarin as opposed to something else, for instance.
Excuse me, Phyllis, but there has been an argument put forth by some members of the administration that the rebel forces really don't have the equipment to have brought this.
Well, there's different assessments of that. Some experts have said that some of the equipment that was found around the area was what appeared to be not quite homemade, but sort of informally made, if you will, rocket launchers that may not have been traditional rocket launchers. And additionally, we don't know who among the defectors from Syria's military, who were part of the early stages of militarizing the opposition as much as 2 years ago, we have no idea who those people are, if any of them may have come from the chemical weapons capacity. They may have defected with some of those weapons. We just don't know. So the notion that we could go to war in response to this huge lack of information is wrong on its face, but it's also illegal. You know, international law is vague on a lot of things, but it's clear on one thing in the UN Charter, and that is there's only two ways that international law allows the use of force. One is if it's immediate self-defense, and nobody is claiming in the U.S. that this horrific attack on civilians with a chemical weapon is somehow an issue of self-defense for the United States. So that's not going to fly. The other is if the Security Council approves. That's clearly not going to happen, with Russia and China about to veto any kind of military intervention. So any kind of military intervention will be illegal. The so-called Kosovo precedent that we've been hearing a lot about looks at what was done in 1999 to allow the attacks on Serbia and Kosovo, but that attack was illegal. What the U.S. did at that time, the Bush administration decided that since they couldn't get Security Council approval, there would be a Russian veto. They wouldn't ask the Security Council, and instead they would ask the NATO High Command, and of course, the NATO High Command said, yes, military intervention is required.
Well, this is likely to follow. This is likely to follow probably a similar trajectory. But when you talk about international law, of course, those on the side of intervention say that the use of poison gas is in violation of international law and has to be answered or has to be responded to. We've got a red line in the sand and all that. But I'm just wondering, though, since you brought up Kosovo, there's been a lot of allusions now to the United States letting Iraq take a pass in the Iran-Iraq war in the use of poison gas and maybe even enhancing the possibility.
More than taking a pass, the U.S. was part of it. The U.S. provided satellite material to the Iraqi government to use to the Iranian government to use poison gas in that war. That was in a horrific situation for almost a decade where the U.S. was basically supporting both sides. Essentially, U.S. arms manufacturers were making a killing, as it were, on the deaths of thousands and thousands of young Iraqis and Iranians, keeping that war going. And part of it involved providing satellite information about how to target the Iranian troops when Iraq used that poison gas. So the U.S. has a history with this. And the end of the day is, yes, there needs to be accountability. It's a huge war crime to use chemical weapons against anyone. That doesn't give anyone, like the United States, permission to use military force as a punishment. It's not going to punish Bashar al-Assad. It's going to punish whichever civilians, even the Pentagon admits, may well be killed in these strikes.
Let me remind you that Phyllis Bennis is on with us. She's a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, and Anya Manuel, is also here, lecturer in international policy studies at Stanford. I want to bring on a couple of other voices for you to hear on this subject. And Amr Al-Azam is associate professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University in Ohio, a member of the Syrian opposition, and he joins us from his office there. And thank you for being back with us, Professor Al-Azam. Now, we're hearing, you know, some very salient arguments back and forth, but the concern, of course, with those who are in favor of military opposition or even those who are opposed to it is that military intervention, will aid the opposition. The opposition is right now too overwhelmed by Islamic jihadists. And I wonder what you say about that argument, that, in other words, either way, the United States maybe has no dog in this fight, as they would put it.
Okay, well, let me just sort of clarify a few points. I mean, I was listening to some of the conversation that was going on just now, and let me clarify a few points. The first thing we need to, you know, make very clear here is that innocent, you know, civilians are being killed, innocent or not. I mean, you know, civilians are being killed, and they're being killed using chemical weapons. What this strike will do, at the very, very least, is act as a deterrent to prevent Assad, because it sends a clear and unequivocal message for the first time that this is a red line that we will not tolerate being crossed. Okay, so that means that at the very least we come out of this, the regime will understand that it can no longer use with impunity chemical weapons. If we achieve just that simplest of goals, if you wish, we will have essentially stop the regime from continuing to use this awful weapon.
Forgive me, you are certain that the opposition was not in any way involved, or
well,
that some
rogue group. This is a bogus argument. We don't even need to go into it. I mean, using chemical weapons is not like sprinkling frosting on a cake. It takes the delivery of to ensure that these chemicals, anybody can mix chemicals together, but to ensure that those chemicals arrive and explode and mix in the right way in order to have the desired effect is a complex process, and that's why you have specialized delivery mechanisms with specialized warheads that do this. And only the regime has this, so I don't think we even need to discuss this any further. The second thing that we know that is happening, and in fact, I've just been on with our contacts inside. Apparently, there is a state of panic amongst the regime soldiers, the regime's military. They're dispersing. Some of them are deserting, and so on and so forth. So, if at the very least, if just the mere threat of a strike is enough to have this kind of impact on the regime, okay, then it is having the desired effect. In essence, what you do with a strike like this, a controlled strike, a controlled message that sends a very clear and loud message to the regime: this is the red line, and you will not cross this anymore. It basically stops the regime from continuing killing people. And at the end of the day, this is what's happening. People are being killed.
Amr Al-Azam, again, is associate professor of Middle East history and anthropology at Shawnee State University and a member of the Syrian opposition. I want to bring Andrenik Magranyan on, who directs the New York-based Institute for Democracy and Cooperation, which is a Russian-funded think tank in New York. And, of course, Russia is very much opposed to military intervention, and there have been some strong rhetoric from Vladimir Putin and others in the Russian administration. Andrenik Magranyan, good to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
With you, I know it is a question of international law and violation of international law to have military intervention against Syria. But apropos of what we just heard from Professor Amr Al-Azam, you and the Russians are also concerned about what this would do in terms of allowing jihadists to organize bloodbaths. And I believe you said on All Things Considered, talking to Robert Siegel, that compared to what could happen, what is happening now is just a joke.
Yeah, that's true. And, I am surprised that the previous assistant professor said that there is no need even to discuss that opposition could use chemical weapons. The problem is that during his last press conference, Minister Lavrov said that Russian chemical analysts, they investigated the use of chemical weapons March 19th, and came to conclusion that these chemical weapons were used by opposition, and they submitted that to Security Council, to UN. But our Western partners just ignored that, which means that these opposition fighters are not so innocent as it seems to the member of Syrian opposition, which means there is a very clearly biased position, because instead of doing a real investigation and finding out all the facts, in advance, Kerry declared that Syrian government is behind these actions. And another problem is very interesting for me and important. I think that from time to time, President Obama is making some statements, then he is putting himself in a trap. I remember, it reminds me when he said, Mubarak must go. And after that, Pentagon practically organized through Egyptian generals the coup and toppled down Mubarak, which means if president said it must be done because he is the leader of the greatest country in the world, the mightiest country in the world. But who said that he is doing something right? Because recently military did another coup and then released Mubarak, which means when you are doing a wrong statement and then being a president, you are putting yourself and your country in a trap. The same, I never agree with Professor Brzezinski on many issues, but recently in his interview to Russian newspaper, he said, who convinced President Obama that he has to say that Bashar al-Assad has to go? Why? When he enjoyed support of a large number of people over there, enjoyed the support of military forces, he is representing minorities, religious minorities, ethnic minorities. And when he is going, who is coming next? When you don't have any idea who is coming, how you can say that he has to go?
Well, let me just get you. I'm sorry. I just want to get you on record about something that. What is the Russian position? I mean, would it be in favor, presumably, of some kind of negotiated settlement that was initiated Geneva 1 or Geneva 2 with participation on all sides? How do you bring both sides to the table, or how do you even manufacture that?
You know, Russia's position was very clear, but unfortunately, Americans didn't give any incentive to opposition forces to come to the to sit at the table and to negotiate. Because when Western position is that Assad has to go, then there is no incentive for opposition forces to sit at the table. That's why they practically blocked this opportunity when Russia initiated Geneva 1. And now Geneva 2 also is blocked practically, because if Obama said that there is a red line, why he said that this is the red line? Now he is again in a trap, because he put himself in a difficult situation. He has to use force because he said that somebody is crossing the red line.
Andranik Magranyan, again, is director of the New York-based Institute for Democracy and Cooperation, a Russian-funded think tank in New York. And I thank you for being with us. Many do say the line in the sand maybe has become a bit of an albatross, but you may want to register your own thoughts here. And we do welcome your involvement in the program. Should the U.S. intervene militarily in Syria is obviously the most elemental and basic question. We welcome your calls. Toll-free, 866-733-6786. Whether you're listening on radio, internet, or satellite, feel free to join the program, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum. We'll continue with Phyllis Bennis and Anya Manuel. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny, and President Obama has said repeatedly that the use of chemical weapons in Syria would cross a red line for the United States. With banned chemical weapons purportedly unleashed on rebel-held suburbs of Damascus last week, a U.S. intervention in Syria seems, according to many, unavoidable at this point, and we're asking experts what next steps ought to be in place for the United States and Syria, and we want to hear from you. Should the U.S. intervene militarily in Syria? There are a number of ways to join us. Our phone lines are fairly occupied, to put it mildly, but the toll-free number is 866-733-6786. Our email address is forum@kqed.org, or you can, of course, post any questions or comments you have right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or go to our Facebook page. We spoke earlier with Andrenik Magranyan from the New York-based Institute for Democracy and Cooperation, a Russian-funded think tank in New York, and with Amar al-Azam, who is actually a member of the Syrian opposition and associate professor of Mideast History and Anthropology at Shawnee State. With us for the hour is Phyllis Bennis, a fellow with the Institute for Policy Studies, who's the author of Challenging Empire, How People, Governments, and the UN Defy U.S. Power, and Before and After, U.S. Foreign Policy and the War on Terrorism. And here in studio, Anya Manuel is with us, a lecturer in International Policy Studies program at Stanford and a partner at Rice-Hadley Group, LLC, a strategic consulting firm. She served in the State Department 2005 to 2007. And we'll go to your calls and emails forthwith here. I wanted to go back, though, to Anya Manuel, and I know you had some response to what you just heard from our two call-outs there. But when we think about the United States and its involvement in using poison gas, whatever that involvement might have been, on the side of Iraq in the Iran-Iraq War, or for that matter, dumping uranium or white phosphorus, Agent Orange, and so forth, there's a lot of reason to hold the hypocrisy here to the fire, isn't there?
Absolutely. The use of chemical weapons is, of course, an atrocity. It is one of the things that almost the entire international community agrees is beyond the pale. People who have used chemical weapons include Hitler, Mussolini, Saddam Hussein. But I just want to take one step back because I think the reasons for intervening in Syria, and let me be clear, I'm not advocating a full-scale military intervention like we did in Iraq, but the reasons for intervening here go far beyond Obama's redlining chemical weapons. And it's actually in Syria, a massive humanitarian crisis, and coupled with that, a resurgence of al-Qaeda, which now has safe havens both in northern Syria and in Iraq. And that resurgence of al-Qaeda, along with the sectarian conflict, creates a massive instability in the entire Middle East. And if nothing is done about the Syrian conflict, that will have repercussions for decades. You see it in Iraq, where al-Qaeda instigated sectarian fighting threatens the fragile Baghdad government. Just yesterday, 80 were killed in a Shia neighborhood. In Lebanon, there's massive political violence. 40 people killed last week, 30 people the week before. In Saudi Arabia, the conflict is stirring up the rest of Shia minority in the midst of a difficult royal succession period for them. And Jordan and Turkey are just reeling under the burden of the Syrian refugees. So doing something in Syria is not just about chemical weapons. It's about much more than that.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, there is fear nonetheless that doing any kind of military intervention, I know, could exacerbate and make the region even more unstable. In fact, President Assad has said he would respond to aggression, so he's kind of made a bit of a red line here in the sand as well. But what about the argument that we heard that this is a preventive action, and not only a preventive action, but a humanitarian action? You know, there are still many who feel we should have done something about Rwanda. We should have done something in Congo.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We should do a lot of things. Military strikes, cruise missile strikes isn't one of them, especially right now in Syria. This will not stabilize the situation. This will make things worse. This will bring in major players. We already have 5 wars being waged in Syria. There's a war besides the civil war. There's a war between al-Qaeda and the regime of their own. There's a war, a regional power war, largely led between Iran and Saudi Arabia with their relative supporters on each side. There's a sectarian war between Sunni and Shia on the regional side. There's a global war between the U.S. and Russia. And there's a war between the U.S. and Israel on the one hand and Iran on the other hand over their nuclear questions. So with all of those wars are being fought to the last Syrian. What this does is to escalate it even further. It also, nobody's answering the point about it's illegal. You know, the notion that we should do something is absolutely right. The something cannot be military strikes. One, in terms of efficacy, because it won't work. Two, in terms of legality, because it will be illegal. So we have to look at things like the International Criminal Court, which because of U.S. opposition right now is too weak to have real enforcement of its own, but it's a starting point. The U.S. needs to get out there and say, we were wrong to refuse to support the court. We want to support it now, and we're going to make sure that it's strengthened and that it has actual enforcement capacity. That could be a huge positive outcome from the strain of what we're seeing right now in the region. We also have to look at questions of massively escalating support for the humanitarian urgency that we've been hearing about. You know, the U.S. has paid a lot, but hasn't paid nearly as much as it should, given U.S. responsibility for the overall crisis in the region. We owe an enormous debt after the illegal war in Iraq, after the continuing war in Afghanistan. The U.S. owes enormous debts to that region for this kind of instability that is very much our obligation.
I'm glad you mentioned Iraq and Afghanistan, Phyllis, because we're getting a lot of responses that should be part of this conversation. And
indeed.
I don't mean to omit it here. Quite the contrary. In fact, it came up in the British Parliament action that I alluded to earlier. As you can imagine, many of the Labour Party members were quite forceful in demanding that the use of chemical weapons be proven to be on Assad's shoulders and so forth.
And it's beyond, I mean, I think that we do have to be very clear that part of the reason that at least 60%, and I think that today's polls are even higher, of the American people are saying no to military intervention in Syria is, one, because people don't believe it's going to do any good, but two, because they don't believe there's evidence. I don't think enough people understand why it would also be illegal. I wish they did.
So when you heard the professor say this isn't even a talking point, the evidence?
Yeah, that's just wrong. It is a talking point, and it has to be. We have to be making sure that there is a serious investigation. Step one is what the UN is doing right now. That team is determining what it was that was used. What was this weapon that killed so many people? How was it used? Number two, the next step will be to determine who used it. And there needs to be serious consequences in terms of arrest and trial and jail and fines. And if they're in a country like Syria, which is not a party to the court, or in the United States for that matter, if they got here, they might not be sent off to the court either. We haven't signed on to the court in a functional way either. The punishment is then they can't leave, because if they go to any other country that is a signatory to the International Criminal Court, they would be sent off to The Hague to stand trial. These things need to be taken seriously. The real punishment has to go to those people who order these kinds of attacks, not people who might die under cruise missiles because we want to send a symbolic message.
All right, and I want to go to our callers here. Quickly, though, Anya Manuel, just wonder what your response is to one of our listeners who writes, this is Joe. Your guest, Anya Manuel, stated that Secretary Kerry gave a very forceful speech, and he would not have given such a forceful speech if he did not have strong evidence Assad or his generals had executed the chemical attack. I remember Colin Powell's speech at the United Nations, which was forceful but not backed up of any evidence of WMDs. And, of course, that analogy again of Iraq.
Yep. There are these frightening parallels between what we were facing in 2002 and 2003 and what you see with the pressure again being on the intel community to come up with very solid answers when the nature of intelligence is sketchy and imperfect and you're dealing with percentage chances that something happened or didn't.
Foreign Policy Magazine, of course, had something about intercepted phone calls that presumably backed up the intelligence. Phyllis, you were going to say something quickly, please, because I want to go to callers.
Just that sometimes we have lies. Let's be clear. Sometimes it's not just insufficient intel. Sometimes it's politically motivated decisions to simply make stuff up. So I think, you know, we have to be very clear about that.
Do you think that's the case here?
I don't know what's the case here. The problem here is we don't have any evidence yet. I don't think that we're having lies yet, except from what Kerry said. That was a lie when he said that clearly the regime in Damascus had deliberately delayed their answer in order to degrade the material. That was a lie. He knew that the formal request from the United Nations had not been delivered until Saturday, and yet he claimed that the press release delivered on Thursday was somehow some obligation of the of the Syrian government to respond, and therefore it proved that they were trying to delay. That was simply a lie. Beyond that, we don't have evidence of lies yet, but we certainly did last time around Iraq.
And let me go to our callers, and we begin with you, Peter. Welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. Military action need not be all at once. So the beauty of the no-fly zone, it's a kind of non-violent, non-destructive first step, which would be enforcing and saving face for the administration and so on. Then, thereafter, another nonviolent first step would be creating military-protected safe zones right around the border in the refugee camps and so on, and also in the diaspora, and just starting a process to do what we're doing here, but get closer in. And then if military intervention into the country, or possibly the government of Syria might cooperate, especially when the alternative is more destructive measures, setting up these safe zones and allowing citizens to blow off steam and give intelligence to the entire world, streaming on the internet, and then some of the best segments could be perhaps rebroadcast on BBC and PBS and NPR and their equivalents all around the world.
All right, Peter, I thank you for the call. He's talking about something incremental, which I guess is really what you're saying, Anya Manuel.
Yeah, I agree absolutely with the listener. This has very much been portrayed by much of the media as a binary option. Are we going to war? Are we not? But just as the listener said, there is a range of options here that starts with humanitarian aid to rebels. I agree completely with Phyllis that we need to do much more on that front, to weapons aid to missiles, to cruise missiles, to a no-fly zone, a possibility of providing air cover for a rebel advance like we did in Libya. I'm not sure I would support that far, but it must be something that the Obama administration is considering, all the way to air cover and then putting in peacekeeping troops like we did in Kosovo in 1999, all the way to a massive ground war like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
And this kind of limited action makes no sense to you, Phyllis Bennis.
No, Michael, we have to be very clear here. There is nothing nonviolent about a no-fly zone. As the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff warned us on the eve of the Libya intervention, which, as we recall, was also stated, this isn't about regime change until it was. What he said was, we need to remember that the first act of a no-fly zone is an act of war, because the first thing you have to do is take out all the anti-aircraft systems. Syria has by far the best air force after Israel in the entire region. It's far better than anything that Libya had. And the notion that it would be somehow nonviolent to start simply announcing a no-fly zone and enforcing it without taking that out means that U.S. pilots would be shot down. Then you would have boots on the ground to rescue them. So, you know, we have to be very clear about what these very nice-sounding names like a no-fly zone, a secure zone, these are military actions that have military consequences, both in the short and long term.
And more of your calls. Arsenio, you're on. Good morning.
Sure. Morning. How are you?
Good morning to you, sir.
So I do want to make a comment. You know, Syria is not part of the chemical weapons ban in the United Nations Charter. And also, you know, those two reasons for force haven't been met, which is that the Security Council has to vote to have active force and that it's self-defense. So I don't see why we're even having this discussion. They didn't break any law.
Okay, I thank you for the comment. Actually, a lot of our listeners are writing that the United States needs to honor the United Nations in any action it takes. And, of course, there are concerns also about getting authority or at least agreement or some kind of receptiveness from the U.S. Congress. John Boehner is on record as saying he wants to know, and certainly the GOP, that is the Republican Party, wants to know. Let me go to more of your calls. Joseph, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, my question is, it's regarding the issue of intelligence. Is our intelligence in Syria a lot better than it was back in Iraq? I mean, we've had, you know, 12 plus years of, you know, intelligence assets, et cetera, all of the work that came as a result of Iraq. And I guess the next part of that question is, isn't there the potential, if our intelligence is bad, that this is just a trap? I mean, Assad could have essentially these chemical weapons located in these command and control locations that we would conceivably hit with a missile strike, so that the United States is then creating, you know, a chemical attack in a way. I'll take my answer on the air.
Okay, I thank you for the question. I think it's pretty much agreed that it would be ill-advised to hit chemical weapons, even if the United States knows where they are stored. It could not only create problems for, obviously, citizens in Syria, but it would be potentially disastrous. But the idea of, let me go to you on this, Phyllis Bennis, the idea that the caller brings here about intelligence and whether or not it's gotten any better since Iraq, is there anything to support?
Well,
that?
I think one big difference is that the U.S. has had diplomatic relations with Syria until the last 2 years. But that doesn't mean that its intelligence is very good. 2 days ago, the Israeli mass publication, Yediot Aharonot, one of the big mass dailies in Israel, quoted top Israeli military officials essentially gloating over the fact publicly that they had provided to the U.S. the so-called evidence of phone transcripts that is providing the Obama administration with what they are calling indisputable evidence. Now, if it comes from Israel, it's going to be even more questionable given the Israeli role in the region vis-a-vis Syria and elsewhere in the region overall. So, you know, I don't know if that's true, but I do know that the Israeli press is publishing these, you know, military sources saying they're the source for it. That would not speak to well-developed U.S. direct intel. Certainly we have the mechanical kind, the eyes in the sky, NSA-style picking up of phone conversations and that sort of thing. But the human intelligence that is so crucial, I would say it's pretty shabby on the U.S. side.
And Anya Manuel, would a limited action militarily deter or degrade the use of chemical weapons, do you think?
I think cruise missiles alone probably won't have that effect. And that's why I hope that the Obama administration is very actively considering what happens after. If cruise missiles, in fact, are the first, the chapter one, what is chapter two?
Well, what's the end game here? I mean, also,
exactly. What's the end game? And as I said before, in my view, the end game should be, at a minimum, allowing the moderate rebel forces to fight to a stalemate so that you can then have a negotiated settlement that would probably remove Assad from power, but permit some protections for minorities such as the Alawite Shias, the Christians, as well as the Sunni majority.
Well, let me read some comments from listeners. Eric writes, we should think about what would have happened if the roles of the United States and Russia were switched in this situation. If Russia chose to violate UN law and Syrian sovereignty, the U.S. would almost undoubtedly rattle the saber against Russia for its interference. If the U.S. chooses to ignore both of these governing bodies, then it will be willfully violating both domestic and international law. Such actions have become all too commonplace by a nation that seems to have forgotten what it once stood for, i.e. rule of law, liberal democratic law. A tweet from a listener named Kim who says, why would we ever support rebels that include al-Qaeda forces? Stay out of wars between religious factions. Jeffrey writes, where in the United Nations Charter or the U.S. Constitution does Syria's alleged use of chemical weapons make bombing Syria legal? If the USA bombs Syria, will we use white phosphorus, napalm, cluster bombs, and or depleted uranium? What is the moral difference between a nation using chemical weapons and it using conventional weapons against its own people? And a listener asks, UN inspectors are in Syria. Why not wait for their report? Was this part of the plan already? What do your guests have to say about General Wesley Clark's statement that Syria was a part of the plan for years now? Well, it's an interesting notion, Phyllis Bennis, not to bring in paranoia here, but Syria has always been looked on as a terrorist state by the United States. And then there's the Cold War, the alliance between Syria and Russia.
Well, we should be very clear
and,
here.
Oh, excuse me. And also, let's figure Iran in this, too, because Iran is a very strong supporter of the Assad regime, and we have to realize that that's part of the calculus.
A lot of what we're doing right now in Syria has everything to do with Iran. The reason that Israel changed its position from one that they had held for the last 2 years of the Syrian civil war, where they stood back and did not support, did not call for U.S. intervention in Syria, precisely because the Syrian regime, despite all its rhetoric of being a resistance arc or whatever they call themselves, were very helpful to Israel, kept the occupied Golan Heights stable and quiet, kept the border safe, kept the level of violence under control. So despite the rhetoric on both sides, it was a very convenient relationship. It was also, I mean, for all that you can say that the U.S. always saw Syria as a terrorist state, the U.S. under the Bush administration in particular was particularly willing to engage with Syria and ask them to do the dirty work of the so-called global war on terror, to act as the interrogator and torturer of detainees identified by the U.S. and sent directly to Damascus to be interrogated there. So, you know, this isn't a one-way street. I think that the key thing that we're looking at here is that much of this has to do with Iran, but we are recognizing, as this is what Wesley Clark talked about years ago, so many others have as well, is that there is a faction of people in the United States. They're not mostly in office right now. Many of them were in office during the Bush years, who did see the idea of overthrowing a mass number of governments throughout the Middle East, Arab and Iranian governments. There were seven. There was a list. It was known. And certainly Iran was the final cherry on the cake, if you will. But Syria was definitely right there on the list, along with Iraq, Sudan. Lebanon was on the list at one point. This is an ongoing thing. That doesn't mean that the Obama administration is necessarily moving towards implementing some master plan like that. But we should recognize that influential people in this country, in think tanks, once in Congress, formerly in the Secretary of Defense position, and other places around Washington, have had the goal of overthrowing lots of governments in the region and installing some U.S. version of democracy in those countries, as we've seen how well they've done in Iraq.
Now, let me go to Anya Manuel again on this, and I'd be curious particularly to get your thoughts about Iran and all this. Iran has already threatened to retaliate against Israel, and yet Hassan Rouhani, the new leader of Iran, has condemned, he did it on Twitter, in fact, chemical weapons use. So did their foreign minister, Javad Zarif. Of course, back in 2007, President Obama and Vice President Biden also condemned George Bush's use of exceeding constitutional powers by using military intervention in Iraq. Iran does figure in this. Iran is really casting a shadow in this, isn't it?
Absolutely. Iran is critical to the calculus here. And that's actually one of the reasons that we need to stay engaged in the region. And Phyllis, I hope you're not suggesting that there is a conspiracy between former Bush administration and current Obama administration officials to overthrow governments in the Middle East. I think that is far from the truth.
But this administration, I don't
clearly
think it is. I think there were
a lot of the
Bush administration.
If I could finish, a lot of folks who are in the foreign policy establishment, both Republican and Democrat, feel strongly, as do I, that the United States has a role being engaged in the Middle East.
Absolutely.
And the reason we need to do that is because if we abdicate that responsibility, and it is often unpleasant, and if we abdicate that responsibility, other actors will take over, as you have seen in Syria in the past 2 years. We have not engaged in that conflict for good reasons. Americans are understandably very tired of war and very tired of foreign interventions. But because we have not stepped in and helped moderate forces, others, such as the Sunni Arab regimes, have helped those rebel forces that we absolutely would not support, such as those allied with al-Qaeda or other Islamist groups. And we find ourselves in a very difficult position because of our lack of engagement. That doesn't mean anybody is arguing for a full-scale intervention.
All right. I want to bring another caller on, and that's you. Roger, join us. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. What we're talking about here is essentially a civil war, and we have a very poor track record in fighting and getting involved in civil wars. We have spent, over the last decade, over $4 trillion. We're talking about enhancing our involvement in the Middle East. I've traveled through Israel 4 times, into Egypt. I believe we should be involved in that area, but not militarily. We can do a lot of humanitarian service in that area. We don't have to constantly think of war in our military. The only one who wins out of this whole thing is our arms manufacturers. They seem to be succeeding tremendously with this, our involvement. So I suggest that we step back, let things evolve as they are going to. I don't want to see any more decimated Christian communities like we had in Iraq. It's also going to happen in Syria, particularly if al-Qaeda moves in strong in to support an overthrow of the Syrian regime. We have to be careful. We can't afford any more of this.
All right, Roger. I thank you for your comments, and I want to read some more comments here. Gabriel writes, so we have a choice in Syria. We can either support the rebels, which will ultimately promote al-Qaeda to rule, or we can support Assad, which ultimately promotes Iran. Should we be supporting either? And again, we asked the question on Facebook, if you were president of the United States, what action, if any, would you take in Syria? And Matt says, I'm not sure what I would do, but I definitely wouldn't announce it to the world days before. It's a bit like the police giving a drug dealer a courtesy call before kicking the door down. Another listener, Chris, says, ugh, such a horrible situation with no easy decision. If we take action, a dictator will be removed. Society there will collapse. Terrorism will take over. Our citizens could lose lives, and other countries will likely condemn us for intervening. On the other hand, it's heartbreaking to watch people there suffer. Syria's allies have a real chance to influence a positive outcome. I truly hope this ends peacefully. And lots more comments and a little time to read them. Maybe just a final few seconds from each of our guests. Anya Manuel, again, we should intervene because?
We should intervene because the chemical weapons use was an atrocity. But beyond that, there is a massive humanitarian crisis in Syria. The conflict there has festered for long enough that there's now a massive resurgence of al-Qaeda in both Syria and Iraq, which the Obama administration has staked much of its credibility on defeating al-Qaeda. And finally, this conflict is destabilizing the entire region and threatens to split it along sectarian lines. And that's why the United States needs to be involved.
And Phyllis Bennis, we need to stay away and wait because?
No, we don't stay away. We simply don't engage militarily. We engage.
That's what I meant.
We
yes.
push really, really hard for the Geneva II talks. We engage immediately with Russia to say, you have got to stop sending more arms and repairs to the government and get Iran to do the same. We are going to stop the Saudis and Qatar and Turkey and Jordan who are sending our weapons. We should be clear. We're selling those weapons, and we can stop that. We can simply say, we're canceling those contracts. And we'll pay off the military contractors the way the Department of Agriculture pays off the farmers to grow nothing. We'll pay them to not send weapons, and we'll enforce some kind of talks to bring this to an end.
We'll bring this to an end there and leave it there. Phyllis Bennis from the Institute for Policy Studies, thank you so much for joining us. She joined us from the nation's capital. Thank also Anya Manuel, who joined us here in studio, lecturer for International Policy Studies program at Stanford. And thanks also to Andrenik Magranyan from the New York-based Institute for Democracy and Cooperation and Amar al-Azam, who is a member of the Syrian Opposition Associate Professor at Shawnee State University. Thank you, our listeners. Another hour ahead. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.